Good afternoon. I'm Mark Tykaczynski, a provost and executive vice president for academic affairs and at TJU and dean of the Sidney Kimmel Medical College. And I'm pleased to welcome you to the 24th annual Dr. Raymond C. Grandin Lecture. I'm honored to open the program for you and welcome Dr. Risa Lavizmori, President and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. This is a great honor for us to have you here today. Each year, the School of Population Health event brings a prominent national figure in healthcare to the campus and features a panel who provide their insights and commentary. It's always a lively and informative program made possible due to the generosity of a distinguished alumnus of Jefferson Medical College, Dr. Raymond Grandin and his wife, Doris. Raymond Grandin has distinguished himself and brought honor to his alma mater since he graduated from Jefferson Medical College in 1945. From his time as medical student and resident, he began to make his mark to improve the quality of care, promote discussions and collaboration among professionals from different disciplines, and to serve the professional community. Unfortunately, Raymond and his wife Doris aren't able to join us in person today. But we would be remiss if we didn't take a moment to acknowledge Ray's tremendous accomplishments and the Grandin's outstanding generosity and support for the School of Population Health. So on behalf of the Jefferson community, we thank them both for helping us to shape the future of healthcare. And now it's my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. David Nash, Dean of the School of Population Health, who will begin today's program. David is a force that helped us establish the Jefferson School for Population Health. I think the word force is like one of the understatements of the year. The dynamo, you pick it. Force is good. The force. Under his leadership, the School of Population Health grew from a small department to a school that is now recognized around the globe. My thanks go out to you and your faculty. And I could say I had the opportunity to sit down for the first time with the entire faculty of the School of Population Health yesterday, and it's a pretty remarkable group. We're just so fortunate that David has built this incredible juggernaut of a school in record time. So hope you enjoy today's, and sure you will enjoy today's symposium.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much, Mark. Great to be here. So this is the 24th annual Grandin Lecture. I've been at all 24, so it's really been pretty exciting. And I know a handful of you have been at all 24 as well. So it's a very special day on all kinds of levels. I want to take a moment to thank the Department of Medicine and the Chief Residents because, colleagues, you're actually also in the Department of Medicine Grand Rounds. So we're very appreciative of all of their help, recruiting house officers and attendings to come too. I wanted to take a moment to personalize Mark's nice comments about Ray and Doris, and I use their first names because I do feel like one of their children at this point. And I also have to invoke yet another name that will be familiar to many of you, and that is, of course, Dr. Joe Ganella. When I came to this campus in 1990, that's a long time ago, in 1991, Dr. Ganella said to me, you know, we ought to start planning as to who is going to donate a chair in your honor. And that began a 13-year strategy, 1991 to 2004. And on a weekend of JMC alumni reunion, I got a phone call from Dr. Ganella at home. I was mowing the lawn. And I'll never forget, he called me to the phone. My wife says, Dr. Ganella's on the phone. I shut the lawn mower, came in. I said, Joe, what's up? It's a Saturday afternoon. He said, well, I just want to say the deal is done. And then he hung up. And I turned to my wife and I remember, the deal is done. What the heck is he talking about? But the deal was done because he had finally sealed the check, if you would, with Ray over lunch at an alumni affair back in 2004. So Ray and Doris are very special to us. If you do the arithmetic, Jefferson class of 45, if you do the arithmetic, you realize that they're pretty elderly, but they are really totally with the program. Their son David has really taken over the family affairs with regard to Jefferson, and I'm just sad that they couldn't be here, but as Provost Tikashinsky said, they're definitely here in spirit. If you'd like to see pictures of Ray and Doris and all previous 23 speakers, come to the 10th floor of 901 Walnut, and we'll be happy to show you all the black and white photographs. So let me tell you a little bit about today's program, because we are going to make a little bit of a change in tradition, and you'll understand in a moment. In just a minute or so, I'll have the privilege of introducing Dr. Lavizzo More, but here's what we're going to do today. In lieu of a panel discussion, because of our new president, Steve Klasko, I thought, you know, imagine trying to put Dr. Klasko on a panel. I just didn't think that that was going to work. So after Dr. Lavizzo More's presentation, we're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we're going to reconvene under the auspices of the Grandin Society. So what's the Grandin Society? A number of years ago, with Ray and Doris's blessing, we decided to create a membership organization that supports scholarship, scholarly activity, changes in the healthcare system. This is really Ray's real legacy. And it's this membership organization that helps to support our school that we named after Doris and Ray. And those members and other folks who would like to stay after Dr. Lavizzo More's presentation will officially adjourn, and then we'll reconvene after a 10-minute break and have essentially a meeting of the Grandin Society led by Risa and Dr. Klasko. And I'll moderate the conversation. So if you'd like to stay with us after the break, we'd love to have you, but it's, strictly speaking, a meeting of the Grandin Society. With that in mind, we'd love for each of you to join the Grandin Society, and there's much more information about that at our wonderful table out in the lobby. Well, I thought a lot about today, and we schemed for nearly 10 months to get Risa to, as it turns out, come back to campus, because she's also an honorary degree recipient of our School of Nursing and the School of the Health Professions, going back to commencement in 2010. But I had the pleasure of meeting Risa for the very first time on Monday, July 2nd, 1984, 31 years ago. Risa and I were in the same cohort of Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars, and that was the first day of our orientation post-residency on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania and the Wharton School of Business. And I do remember meeting her on that first day thinking, this lady is going places. Now, little did I know that a couple of decades later, she'd become the president of the foundation that was sponsoring our fellowship program, but I almost could have guessed it on July 2nd, 1984. Prior to becoming president of the foundation, and you could read all the details in the wonderful brochure we've prepared for you, the breakthrough article in last summer's Philadelphia Inquirer describing Risa's work. But prior to even getting to the foundation, I was well aware of Risa's activities on the Penn campus, where she became the Sylvan Eisman Professor of Geriatrics. Then after Penn, one of the first administrators of what we call today the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. For nearly a year and a half, she was the first lady, Hillary Clinton's chief go-to policy healthcare expert, and traveled the nation with the first lady at that time in the first White House task force on health reform. So she is no stranger to the halls of power, the halls of influence, and the halls of policymaking. She's been the president of the foundation now for more than 10 years, but I think as it's germane to our school and relevant to the Grandin Lecture, this is a woman who has totally transformed the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation into what I'm going to call a force for population health. So give a super warm Grandin Lecture welcome to Dr. Risa Lavizzo More.
Wow. Well, thank you, David, for that wonderful introduction. You know, when I hear an introduction like that, I often wish my kids were in the audience. many of you can relate to that. You might actually get a little respect at home if they heard that. I do want to thank you for inviting me, David, and also Alexis and the provost, President Clasco. This is really an honor, and it as I was saying to David, sometimes it takes longer to get someone to come just a few blocks than to come from all the way across country. And I am sorry I don't get a chance to actually meet Dr. Grandin and his wife Doris, because I've heard so much about them and the wonderful way that they have been innovators and supporters of everything that you do here. And given that he has been such an innovator, I think it's appropriate to start with something that another great innovator had to say. He said, Einstein said, you know, if at first the idea is not absurd, then there's no hope for it. So in the spirit of these two innovators, I want to talk to you about the absurd idea of having us work together to build a comprehensive culture of health in America. I've been talking a lot about this over the past year, and when I mention a culture of health and building a culture of health, I can see people looking a little bit quizzical and wondering, well, what is she talking about? What does she mean by that? And the truth is that a culture of health means different things to different people. But in general, it means recognizing that health is a key part of everything we do. It's the bedrock of personal fulfillment, the backbone of prosperity, and it's the foundation of a strong, competitive nation. So building a culture of health means creating a society where every person has the opportunity to lead the healthiest life they possibly can. In a culture of health, our children's well-being is a matter of fact, not a matter of chance. And in a culture of health, our kids learn about being active and eating right and being safe, helping others, where they are at school, at home, and at play. In a culture of health, doctors and other providers actually work as partners with their patients, providing them with the information that they need, understanding their needs inside the clinic as well as outside the clinic, implementing that notion that compassion really is a part of the cure. In a culture of health, industry leaders really understand that health boosts their bottom line and vice versa. And they do everything they can to keep their employees healthy and to have their communities healthy as well. In a culture of health, the military can find healthy and hearty recruits, and every one of us has the opportunity to pursue a fulfilling, productive life, not only for ourselves, but for our loved ones, and not considering how much they make or where they come from, or what physical or mental challenges they might have. Now, I know that this is a bold vision, and it's one that I believe that we can achieve. And when we do, we're going to have a very powerful story to tell. It'll be a story about how we no longer accepted that our country spends nearly $3 trillion on healthcare and yet continues to lose $226 billion in productivity because of health issues for people and their families. And it'll be about how we rejected as inevitable that our kids, a third of whom are overweight or obese, have a real chance of being the first generation to live sicker and die younger than their parents' generation, and how we instead committed to make sure that every child grows up with the opportunity to have a healthy weight. And it'll be a story about how we rejected the dismal fact that a group of military leaders took to Congress earlier this year that right now, in 2015, Nearly 70% of America's young adults are too fat, too poorly educated, or too wrapped up in the criminal justice system to be eligible to serve in the military. And that the military spends $1 billion every year treating the consequences of being overweight and trying to undo the long-standing habits that the recruits came to them with. Not only that, but it'll be a story about how we came to accept and respect that getting healthier and maintaining health can mean something very different to those who are living with chronic illness, whether that's mental or physical. Now, I'm calling it a culture of health, but as I've learned in a number of conversations over this past year, I could also call it a culture of care, as some people told me I should on my website, or a culture of well-being, or a culture of empathy. And in fact, it's all of those things, because the truth is, if we can't come together and focus all of these parts of our health, we're not going to achieve a culture of health. And in a culture of health, we are going to really understand that health means much more than simply not being sick. It's a vital aspect of how and where we work, how and where we live, how we educate our children, and how we make everyday decisions for our families. Okay, I'm looking out there. I see that when I paint this rosy picture, a lot of you are skeptical. You're thinking, okay, she's either ill-informed or naive, because right now our nation's healthcare system is not exactly a culture of health. We have too many Americans who are coping with chronic disease. We still know that 50% of Americans die of heart disease, cancer, stroke. We have depression and anxiety disorders that are rampant in the country, causing much more misery than they need to. And every day there are tens of thousands of hospitalizations or rehospitalizations that just don't need to happen. And while we can cheer that high school student smoking rates have plummeted in the last 25 years, we have to take notice of the fact that the percentage of middle school and high school students that are smoking e-cigarettes or using e-cigarettes is rapidly rising. It's tripled in the last year. 13% now use e-cigarettes. And what's even more troubling is that 86% of them thinks it's absolutely harmless. And when you think about our youngest children, there's a growing body of research that tells us that there's critical learning that happens from birth to 3 years old. And yet in most states, our kids don't go to public school until they're five. And for far too many, they're exposed to poverty, family violence, substance abuse. And these are the kinds of adverse experiences that cause the toxic stress that can lead to lifelong health problems and even early death. So, needless to say, these are not the aspects that we want to see in a culture of health. In addition to this, there are far too many people, and I don't have to tell you, who see our healthcare system and the quality of healthcare that people get, the experience that most patients have, as being frankly disorganized, disparate, and sometimes just frankly dismissive. So these are the realities. And we're not going to achieve a culture of health if we keep going down that path. But the good news is that I think as a nation, we're facing the fact that we're headed in the wrong way, and that we have to broaden this concept of health and integrate the work that we do so that we can have a better chance of improving it. Now, this is a school of population health. In population health and public health, we've been talking about these things for years, decades really. Foundation I lead has been at it for 40 years. But I think that there's something happening outside our area that is influencing all of this. And it kind of reminds me of a passage in Ernest Hemingway's book, A Sun Also Rises. Anyone still read books out there? You read? So you remember the part where, you know, one of the characters is saying how his life changed and said it happened gradually and then suddenly. And that's what I'm starting to see with a culture of health. Change is happening gradually and suddenly. I'm seeing people all across the country get really serious and ask how they can make health more a part of their homes, their neighborhoods, their schools, their towns. They're really seeing change gradually and suddenly. Now, I guess about 6 months ago, I heard a lecture by an MIT professor, Jose Gomez Marquez, and he told the story about how he showed some of his graduate students a picture of a blind person, and he asked them, can this person drive a car? And they all started debating, you know, whether or not it was possible. And then he showed the same picture to another set of graduate students, and he asked them, how can this person drive a car? You guessed it. I mean, this is MIT, right? And so they immediately started thinking about how they could make it possible for someone without vision to drive a car. And that's what I'm talking about with the culture of health. We have to stop asking ourselves if it's possible. In fact, I don't even ask that question anymore. I start asking, how can we do it? How can you and I do it? How can startup companies and Fortune 500 companies do it? How can urban neighborhoods and rural communities do it? How can we make sure that we all are working together to make health part of our next national movement? I think one key way, and you know this, is to make sure that people understand all of the things that influence health that they may have never thought of, and yet are the things that are actually directly linked to whether or not we're able to get and stay healthy. Things like, of course, poverty and violence, but also education and economic opportunity, and whether or not the family is resilient, and whether or not there's supportive networks that help that family be resilient. I think when you create these light bulb moments for people, it's hard for them to go back. So let me tell you about my own light bulb moment. I trained at one of the Harvard hospitals in Boston, and as part of an early rotation, we had to go to a hospital in West Roxbury that was just a few miles down the road. And I met a patient there who literally changed my life and who I will always think of as patient Ruth. And she came into the emergency room on a cold night, homeless and helpless, wearing only house slippers. Her legs were swollen with ulcers, and she had a chart that was like that because she had been to the hospital so many times before. And we did what we always did. We gave her a few hours in the warm bed, some antibiotics, a meal. But when morning came, she had to go because the rules said that our job was done. And so she limped back out the door into the cold and the same problems that brought her in. No home, no job, lousy food, and no network of family and friends that she could turn to. Now, our care ended at the front door of the hospital, and that was so very short-sighted because if we had asked ourselves, what did we need to do to keep her from coming back to the hospital? Remember that big chart? And then what if we had linked her up to the people and services that would have kept her out of the hospital? Well, that was my light bulb moment. It was when I realized that there are connections with health that are outside of the healthcare system. And once you start realizing that and realizing that health is not just about food and exercise, it's really about where we live, learn, work, and play, and everything that goes into that, then you actually see that health is a part of our culture, or it certainly should be. And in fact, where you live is so important that your zip code at birth can be as important as your genetic code in predicting how well and how long you're going to live. Now, this is the DC Metro. Many of you know it. And if you are born up there in Montgomery County, you're going to live to be 84 years. But if you're born in downtown DC, you're probably going to live less, about 7 years less. And if you happen to be born in Las Vegas, it's even more striking. Because if you're born out there in the suburbs, you're going to live 16 years longer than if you're born down by the Strip, which is only about 9 miles away. Now, I want you to think about all of the things that can happen in a person's life, in a family's life, over 16 years. And then think about what it means for someone to miss out on all of those things. Think about what it would mean for someone in your family to miss out on all of those things. It's no different here in Philly. I don't have a map for you yet, maybe next week. But if you live around here, and I live pretty close to Washington Square, I was out walking a couple of days ago and realized that just 2 miles north or 2 miles west or 1.7 miles east in Camden, the life experience and the ability to be healthy is vastly different. So the point is, we're asking us to think about all of those factors. And you're probably at this point saying, all right, so what does a culture of health look like for an entire nation? Well, that's easy. The World Health defined it years ago, and it's pretty much this definition. But imagine what that looks like if in every town, in every place we can think of, you had the basic building blocks to have a culture of health. If doctors like this one shared their medical records openly with patients and discussed with them what it would take to not only get well, but also save money. In other words, had that difficult conversation about price and value. And what if we could walk and bike instead of drive, or we had access, all of us, to safe, affordable communities where you could plant a garden or meet up with friends or just be outside on those days when it's nice in Philadelphia? Imagine what it would be like if employers and mayors and school superintendents worked side by side to make sure that people had the tools and the information that they needed to make smart, responsible choices. I think that that's what a culture of health looks like nationally. It may be different for you. You may be thinking it's more about how we educate our kids, or you may be thinking it's more about how we ensure that we have clean air and water in this country. Or you may be thinking it's about how we change our perspective on how people age to make sure that they can age in place in their homes and be safe and get the care they need and deal with the issues of end of life. The question is, how are we going to get there? So, let me ask a question. How many of you drove in here and then are spending the vast majority of your day sitting at a desk? Well, you know the study, yeah? Okay, I see the hands. Probably more than are willing to admit it, but you all know the studies, right? That if you sit more than 8 to 10 hours a day, you have a higher probability of having heart disease, diabetes, and there is a decrease in life expectancy. So my question to you is, how are we going to change this behavior for ourselves and for others? We have the ability to do this as ordinary people and as leaders. We could institute policies where you take the stairs. You could park a little further away from the front door. I know those parking spaces next to the door are coveted. We can make sure that meetings end 10 minutes early so that people actually have a chance to take a little walk before they go to their next meeting. You could actually have walking meetings, set up a friendly competition to make sure that people get steps in. You know, they're doing it in Washington. I read in the Washington Post that members of Congress are using Fitbits and Jawbones to track their steps, and they're literally walking around in circles in the Capitol, outdoing each other so that they can get their steps in. There are a lot of ways that we can do it. It would be great if companies actually competed on how healthy their employees are. And if they put those statistics in their annual reports right next to their financials and their safety statistics. And what if towns actually paid attention to the fact that in 25 years there are going to be 80 million people over age 65 and started making the changes in their infrastructure and in their policies to ensure that people can actually stay home and be healthy in their homes? These are the kinds of things that I ask myself when I say, how are we going to get to a culture of health together? It's going to be gradually and suddenly. I think about this doctor, Dr. Sagbir, who lives in Columbus, Ohio. And he's a cardiologist who has started an organization called Walk with a Doc. It's now all over the US, it's in Europe, it's in India. And it started out of a sheer frustration that he had, where he would have his patients come in, promise that they were going to become physically active, change their diet, and then 6 months later, they were back doing the same thing. So one day, out of sheer frustration, he invited a patient to come walk with his family on Saturday morning, and that led to a movement. He didn't think about starting a movement to build a culture of health, but in fact, that's what he's doing. And that's what CVS did last year when they said they were no longer going to sell tobacco products in their stores. And that's what the American Academy of Pediatrics did last year when they officially recommended to doctors that they recommend to their patients that they read a book, Cat in the Hat, I don't care what it is, or sing De Coloris, anything to their kids on a daily basis so that they stimulate brain development. It's happening gradually and suddenly. We're seeing the integration. Now, there's an African proverb that teaches the wise aim at boundaries beyond the present. So let me voice the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's vision right here. It's that as a nation, we will strive together to build a culture of health so that all in our diverse society can live healthier lives now and for generations to come. Notice I said healthier, not healthy, healthier, because wherever you are, you can always be healthier. It's our vision, it's what we're working towards, but we are very mindful of the fact that even though we're the nation's largest philanthropy dedicated to health, we can't do this alone. Because we don't make policy, we don't sell anything, we don't make any products, we don't deliver any health care. The only power that we have is to bring people like you together who have big ideas with other people who have the commitment and drive to stick with it until it gets done. And that's how we're going to build a culture of health over the next 20 years. Now, at our foundation, we have been focusing on a few areas that we think require immediate attention. Childhood obesity is one. 8 years ago, we committed $500 million to reversing the epidemic of childhood obesity. And nationally, we're seeing progress. That relentless rise that was going up for 30 years has started to level off. And among our youngest kids, those 2 to 5, you're actually starting to see a decrease. But the truth is, the progress is fragile and it's uneven. White children and children in high-income areas are much better off than black and brown children and children in poor neighborhoods. And as I mentioned earlier, we still have 1/3 of our kids who are overweight or obese. So we've decided that now is not the time to take our foot off the pedal. We have to ensure that all children enter kindergarten at a healthy weight. We have to make sure that school environments that are healthy are the norm, not the exception, and that physical activity is a part of every child's life every day, and make sure that healthy foods are affordable and the default choice in every neighborhood. And finally, we have to eliminate, and I do mean eliminate, the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages from birth to 5 years old. And that's why we've decided to commit another $500 million so that we won't lose ground and get everyone on this bandwagon of addressing childhood obesity. We also are focused on coverage. It's very clear that we've had an increase in the number of people who are covered, over 16 million since the Affordable Care Act was enacted. But we want to make sure that the tens of thousands who aren't insured get coverage, because that's an unacceptably high rate if we're going to build a culture of health. And we want to make sure that people know how to get the most out of their health care insurance. We want to make sure that as a nation, we're focused on how we can increase the value, trim the cost, reward appropriate care, and make sure that people's personal health goals are aligned with what the healthcare system is delivering. Every community should be able to have high quality, high value public health. And so we're committed to making sure that happens. We want to make sure that people have access, as I said, to the tools and information that they need to make the kind of decisions that will allow them to maintain or reclaim their own health. And we want to make sure we encourage business to take a lead in addressing the well-being of their communities and to address the important issues like these. Now, let me just stop here for a moment and tell you about a deep conviction that we have at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We believe that we're never going to be a healthy nation if we continue to be a violent one. And so one of our principal aims has been to focus on the long-term ramifications of violence, those adverse child experiences that can lead to toxic stress and violence later in life. We believe our society is not going to achieve a culture of health if people, through no fault of their own, are unable to have good health because of the barriers that they face. Now, I believe deeply that personal responsibility and the choices we make are critical to health. But I also know that the choices people make is often related to the choices that they have. And when one in five live in neighborhoods that don't have jobs, don't have healthy food, are plagued by pollution, we have to overcome these barriers if we're going to have a culture of health in America. So these are not easy issues, to be sure. But this is America. This is where people set the agenda. And it's time for us to make a seismic shift in how we think about health and how we recalibrate our own behavior as individuals and our expectations as a nation. It's only through that that we're going to be able to forge the kind of partnerships that will bring everyone under the tent. Why do I think a shift like this is possible? Well, it's happened before. Back in 1970, the year Earth Day was established, recycling was not a part of our lexicon, much less a part of our behavior. But people began asking, why are we fouling our oceans with paper and plastic and that could be recycled and used for other purposes? And then they began insisting on a change. And now we automatically recycle. Why? Because we've made it easy. You have recycling bins everywhere. They're in stores, they're in offices, they're in hotels. And most of you, I bet, if you accidentally throw the coffee grounds in with, you know, a can, I bet you, like I, get in there and fish it right out. Now, another shift happened when 911 came into being. Some of us are actually old enough to remember when there wasn't a single number to call in an emergency. And when patients were wheeled into hospitals without getting any first aid, the people in the emergency room had no idea they were coming, and as a result, people died. All that changed when someone had the idea to have a single number and a connection between the first responders and people in the hospital. Simple idea, but a revolutionary change. And now every child in America knows to dial 911 as soon as they become infatuated with the phone, right? And some can even text, you know, you can even text it someplace. So we have to stop asking whether we can build a culture of health and start asking how we're going to make this our next big national movement. And in, when we do, we will look back on it with the same disbelief that I got from my little granddaughter when I told her, you know, there was once upon a time, there wasn't any 911. And she shocked, Grandma, really? What did people do? That's what we want to see happen. Because in reality, it's like William Gibson said, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. And that's true in health. There are a growing number of communities all around the country that are demonstrating that we really can do this. So let me introduce you to a few of these folks. This is a social entrepreneur named Rebecca Ani, and she's developed a program called Health Leads that allows clinicians to prescribe things like food and heat in the same way they prescribe medications. And then college students go out and fill those prescriptions. Some of you may have heard about it. It's been adopted by Kaiser Permanente, and it's being diffused all over the country. When I met her, and when I think about what she's doing, I can only remember my patient Ruth and wish that a program like this had existed for her. There are industry leaders who are stepping up as well. Have you heard of the Healthy Weight Commitment? That's a group of 16 companies, food companies, that made a pledge to take 1.5 trillion calories out of the food supply over a three-year period. And when I usually when I talk about this and say, you know, these are companies like Kraft and PepsiCo and ConAgra, people get skeptical. Yeah, it couldn't happen. Well, not only did they meet their goal, they blew it out of the water. And not by 50% or 100%, but by 400%. They took 6.4 trillion calories out of the food supply and did it in a year's less time than they had promised. And then I've got to tell you about McAllen, Texas. How many of you remember the infamous McAllen, Texas, where the healthcare costs were higher than any other? And remember how a few years later they had redefined their primary care system so that they were now on a par with others? Well, this is their library. How many of you know that the public library is one of the most trusted institutions in a community? And so what they did was they took an old Walmart and converted it to not just a library, but a super library, one that has an auditorium and a cafe, but also a garden and a market so that people can sell fresh vegetables. And they have cooking classes so that people can learn how to actually prepare that food. They have a cart that has a healthy veggie pizza, not the usual unhealthy kind. And I would be remiss if I didn't tell you about Oklahoma. Oklahoma is one of the most conservative states in the country, and yet Republicans and Democrats have reached across the aisle to make sure that every child in Oklahoma is able to go to pre-K free. They've also collaborated across sectors, bringing business and community leaders together. And in Oklahoma City, these forces have come together to create an incredible one-stop health center, a campus, really, where there's a clinic, there are walking trails, there's a food bank, there's job training, there's a why. Oklahoma is one of the most tax-conservative states in the country, and yet they routinely collaborate. The governor surprised everyone when she outlawed smoking in all state buildings, state parks, state vehicles. So we're seeing change suddenly and gradually in some very unusual places. Now, when you set a goal, particularly a goal as big as this one, you want to have some measures to make sure that you're actually getting there and that you're on the right path. So one of the things that we're going to be doing later on this month is laying out a conversation about some specific measures that fall into these domains so that we can actually see whether or not we're working together as a nation to bring those social, economic, physical, environmental factors together, measuring whether we're doing the right integration to make it happen, and seeing whether it's actually changing things. So we're going to initiate a conversation, as I said, about the measures in these action domains. We want to make sure that we're actually looking at whether people have a shared value and a shared definition of health, whether we're fostering the kind of collaboration across sectors that is so critical and that we've seen works in these communities that are actually building a culture of health, whether we're creating more equitable communities that are healthier, and whether we're strengthening our ability to integrate services across health and healthcare. So these measures are going to go beyond just disease rates. They really will be looking at the factors that we don't usually think about with health, like whether or not people have enough money for food, or how much they're spending on caregiving, or whether there's diversity in a neighborhood as opposed to it being a segregated neighborhood, or one that really resonates with, I think, people now. Do youth feel safe in their neighborhoods? None of these measures are new. They've all been around for years. But what is new is putting them under a single umbrella and calling it health. Because I think one of our problems has been that for too long, health has always been something separate. And unless we bring it together with these other factors, we're never going to be able to weave it into the fabric of American life and actually move the needle. Now, in history, it's sometimes difficult to recognize a big change when you're living it. But here we are, and I'm quite aware that we are standing on a threshold of a new era, and that we really can raise the health of this country to the level that it deserves. And that's why last year we established a prize called the Culture of Health Prize to honor communities that are bringing ordinary people together to create health. And here are the prize winners for last year. These communities are ordinary citizens who come together with business, importantly, nonprofit organizations, universities, to really make a deep commitment to improving the health of their communities and committing to stick with it until they see success. They are very different economically, geographically, but they're all committed to building a culture of health. So let me show you what one of these communities is doing. Williamson.
Williamson, West Virginia, and coal mining are practically synonymous. The mines brought prosperity to the town for generations, but as demand for coal declined, so did the health and well-being of Williamson. Community leaders like Dr. Dino Beckett were determined to turn things around.
We're very tied to the history of coal, and we're very proud of that heritage. It's just with less opportunity with coal, we have to discover other opportunities that we can still raise our families here and have that ability to live here. We lead the state of West Virginia in categories such as obesity, hypertension, diabetes. And that's where we want to make the impact and move the needle in the opposite direction. We want to empower our residents as far as exercising, eating quality foods, learning how to garden, learning how to become entrepreneurs. One key element of Sustainable Williamson has been the community garden. It is located next to lower income housing and gives residents in the area an opportunity to come out and employ their skills as gardeners and entrepreneurs potentially. One of the biggest challenges that Williamson has is access to foods that are healthy. We've been able to work with the community identifying those and make it available through a mobile farmers market or the farmers market in Williamson. We identified more and more patients that were losing their insurance, that were unemployed, or that just couldn't afford to go to the doctor's office. The need was so big that we decided, hey, what about opening up a clinic that would be able to service all of these people that can't afford those quality health care? So in doing so, we had the concept of starting Williamson Health and Wellness, a nonprofit clinic. The task at hand for the community was there were all these problems such as obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. We didn't have a lot of resources, so we were able to identify several groups in the community that were working on various things, and we were able to kind of pull those together under the Blanken Institute of Williamson Health and Wellness Center. When you have that sense of camaraderie that people experience here when they work in the coal mines, they rely on each other when it comes to safety and well-being. So everyone has the urgency and the need to look out for their neighbor, their family member, to help them through hard times, and then also to enjoy the good times.
I think we got a little bit of it cut off, but you get the gist. The point is, you cannot create a culture of health with just healthcare working on the problem. Just like you can't play a symphony with one instrument, we've got to all work together if we're going to build this culture of health and give our kids and our grandchildren an opportunity to live the healthiest life they possibly can. So I hope you'll join with us and do it, and thank you for inviting me here.